Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this.
In a democracy, there is nothing worse than ignoring science.
I'm not a scientist, nor am I a physicist.
I'm not a scientist.
I'm not a scientist.
No one's born a scientist.
Capacity to maintain world-leading
science. Not the doctor of a political party.
I'm not qualified to debate the science over climate change.
To their zeal for discovery.
Today we're kicking off our series looking at how politicians use and often ignore scientific evidence to justify their ideology, and how scientists play politics too, like when they overpromise on scientific breakthroughs to get more research money. We're calling it political science, where evidence and ideology collide. Now, you're probably already thinking of climate change, and that is the classic example where often the facts don't show up in the debate. But we wanted to dig deeper and talk to both policymakers and researchers, because the clash of ideology and science happens all the time in abortion, drug interdiction programs, bans on genetically modified foods, you name it. And it's there that we're going to start today. Anne Glover is Europe's former scientific advisor and currently vice principal for external affairs at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. She served in that role as chief scientific advisor until last November, when her position was abolished. And she says it's difficult to confront both politicians and the public with scientific facts.
The new president of the commission, President Juncker, has decided that he probably doesn't want a single identified figure offering scientific advice or evidence. And so he has said that for the meantime anyway, he wants to dissolve the post, so he isn't immediately looking for a replacement.
Professor Glover, there was a lot of optimism and then a great deal of disappointment around your job. When you were appointed and your job was created, a lot of people were really excited. Look, the European Commission, these politicians, they're really serious. They want objective scientific advice. They want the data to inform their decisions. They want to depoliticize science. That's something a lot of people in the United States are very envious of. And then your departure, which had some controversy around GMOs, and the new president, of course, eliminated the position entirely, was, I think, a similar disappointment, which is it was too much for them. Real data was too much for politicians. It became politically inconvenient.
When you're constructing or developing policy, you need to base it on something. And if you want it to be robust and long-lived, the best possible platform you can use is the evidence, the scientific evidence. The evidence is never 100% certain, but it's our best bet to have something robust and long-lasting. I think that without evidence, then we go into the realms of opinion or philosophy or ideology.
Bring us inside the typical meeting. I'm interested in a case, your personal experience, when you said, "Minister, I appreciate your position. I need to tell you that the best data that we have, all of the papers say this. I have to advise you against doing that." And they look at you and say, "I have voters I have to think about. You don't."
The one area was GM food, where, as you might know, in Europe, generally I would say that European citizens are not in favor of growing and consuming genetically modified crops here. And I have had a number of conversations with politicians where, behind a closed door, they'll say, "Yeah, okay, we do understand the evidence tells us that the technology itself is not harmful. How you use the technology, of course, there is more debate around that, because I would say there are some good applications and some not so good applications of the technology for crop production. But what those politicians would say is that I know that my voters would not be keen if I turned around and said, okay, I think we should vote in favour of using GM technology." My position on this is that politicians are elected and they represent citizens. I, as a chief scientific advisor, I wasn't elected. And so all I can do is offer advice and the evidence. But what I would ask of politicians is that they were honest and truthful, and that they should use the evidence and talk about the evidence available. And where it disagrees with public opinion or ideology or philosophy, just to be straightforward about that.
Doesn't that conversation that you had maybe more than once with the politician where they say, I know you're right, but I can't sell it, mm-hmm. and so we have to go against the data, doesn't that make you want to grab them by the lapel and shake them? Doesn't it just make you want to do that?
It doesn't make me want to do that. You know, I think you have to be very straightforward about the evidence says this, but for other reasons, and it could be public opinion, it could be for economic reasons or social or ethical reasons, all of these are valid. But you, in my mind, you must not say that my excuse is that I'm going to say that the evidence is lacking when it isn't. So that's my frustration.
Do you look upon us with some pity here in the United States? Is it another shade of the same problems that you have? What do you think when you see our climate debate in this country where it's big news if our Congress votes to say that climate change actually exists?
I think what we need to do, and actually US scientists as well as European scientists and others, need to stand up and say, let's make a clear distinction between what the evidence is, which is something that is peer-reviewed, it's argued about, it's refined until it's a very precious and powerful thing. There's a big difference between that and philosophy or ideology or faith. Those are equally valid things, but they should not be confused with the evidence.
Ann Glover is Europe's former scientific advisor, currently vice principal for external affairs at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. Tomorrow, we're going to hear how scientific researchers hyped the promise of stem cell research in a bid to get increased funding. Now, fact or fiction, do you think science is misused for political gain? From Salt Lake City, Utah, when is science not misused for political gain? Small sample sizes, selection bias, equating correlation with causation, all the common missteps of science are used daily to try to prove a political viewpoint. Until the electorate is scientifically literate, science will be in this black box that people don't understand, but politicians will try to manipulate.
This is Alexa from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Science is misused when big companies pay scientists to falsify scientific studies or only publish what makes the company's product look favorable. Politicians also back big companies who misuse science due to the large donations made to their campaigns.
You can join this conversation. We want to hear from you at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's our number. You can tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Kristen Stewart might be a favorite among teenage girls for Twilight. Hey, she's a favorite of mine for her role in The Runaways. Make sure you see it. But since Twilight, that epic series, Stewart has taken on some big roles that could define her career far more than her time as Bella. Her latest role is in the film The Clouds of Sils Maria. In it, Stewart plays a personal assistant to an internationally acclaimed movie star played by Juliette Binoche. Now, Binoche's character is struggling with what it means to age in Hollywood, and Stewart's character has to administer both reassurance and hard truths.
You can't be as accomplished as you are and as well-rounded as an actress as you are and still expect to hold on to the privileges of youth. It just doesn't work like that.
Oh, so I'm allowed to not be old as long as I don't want to be young. Is that it?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess so. Yes. Totally. Well put.
Our own Kristen Meinzer, host of the Movie Date podcast, recently sat down with Kristen Stewart to discuss the latest project.
What was really sort of obvious to me in the beginning and was really attractive was the dynamic between these two women and how sort of indulgently it explores it. It's literally, you know, much of the movie, like an hour and a half of it, is just the two of us sitting and talking and rehearsing this play. And it's about, you know, aging in this business, just being a woman and, you know, the different perspective that a younger person who's not in the business might offer somebody who's completely entrenched in that sort of really esoteric world.
Do you feel that we're in a good time right now for women in Hollywood? Do you feel that there are more challenges and there are more hoops to jump through as a woman at this time?
I'm insanely lucky at this point. I have so much in front of me and I'm, you know, incredibly challenged. And I think that it is more challenging for a woman undeniably to, you know, find things that are bold and, you know, things that are new, things that feel unique. And it takes a woman who wants to find it to really go out and find it.
But you've actually had a lot of, I don't know if you'd call it luck or if it's just that you've worked really hard to find some really unusual roles in the last year or so. Not just The Clouds of Sils Maria, but Still Alice opposite Julianne Moore, which was the film about early onset Alzheimer's, and Camp X-Ray, which is about Guantanamo Bay. Is this something that you've worked really hard to search out for these, you know, to try and get these roles? Or is this something that you were deliberately trying to do to get away from all the Twilight hullabaloo? Or how did you end up going this direction?
I absolutely never made tactful choices in order to separate myself from Twilight. That just, you know, it was a really long period of time, like a huge part of my life. And everything that I've been attracted to since has been quite varied. And I've just been, you know, I don't know. Those projects in this world, they stick out. The ones that seem different, that really say something. Every time I read something like that, I jump on it as if it's this like precious thing that might go away.
And most of this transition's been pretty great as far as going from child actor to teen actor to adult actor, I'd say. I mean, we always are seeing car wrecks of cases where a child actor just completely becomes unraveled trying to make it into the teen or adult world. And you started off really young. A lot of people knew you for the first time when you did Panic Room with Jodie Foster, who also was a child actor who became a very, very successful actor as an adult. Do you ever go to her or go to other co-stars of yours and ask for advice on how to make those transitions?
I've absolutely been shaped by the people I've grown up with. And crazily enough, it has been people like her. And, you know, they're role models and they're doing it the right way. They've really all found balance. And I think that the one thing that they all have in common is that they really love what they do and it's worth protecting. And so, yeah, it's all about finding that balance.
Kristen Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
The Clouds of Sils Maria is out in limited release this Friday. To hear the full interview with Kristen Stewart, you can listen to this Friday's Movie Date podcast. You can also subscribe to it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
2 years after the Boston Marathon bombings of April 15, 2013, and 1 month after his trial began, accused bomber Jahar Tsarnaev faced his final day of trial on Monday. Assistant U.S. Attorney Alok Chakravarti delivered the government's closing arguments, as did members of Tsarnaev's defense team. The prosecution argued that Tsarnaev is a cold-blooded killer intent on plotting an attack on America. His defense team, meanwhile, argued that Tsarnaev took part in the bombing, but argued he was under the influence of his older brother and would not have been in this position had it not been for Tamerlan. It's now up to the jury to deliberate on the case, which will most likely result in a conviction, and on the punishment, which may or may not be the death penalty. Daniel Medwed is a law professor at Northeastern University and an expert in criminal law. He's here to explain where things stand with the trial and what's next. Daniel Medwed, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
Thanks for being with us. Tell us about the closing arguments made by the prosecution. We recap them in brief. Jahar Tsarnaev and his attorneys have not in any way suggested that he wasn't responsible and that he shouldn't be punished.
Absolutely. The thrust of the prosecution's closing argument, Todd, was that Jahar was an equal partner in crime, that he wasn't under the sway of his domineering older brother. Because throughout this trial, the defense theory is that Jahar was just a minor player, that it was Tamerlan who led the charge here. And the idea is that eventually that might be a factor in sentencing. If, in fact, Jahar is considered to be a minor participant, that could prompt the jury to spare his life.
So that's the positioning here. It's all about sentencing. What does the law say? What does the judge say to the jury that makes the idea that he was a follower, not a co-equal in these crimes, relevant here?
Well, in the guilt phase right now, Todd, it's not particularly relevant. What matters is whether the prosecution can prove these counts, and there are 30 counts, 17 of which potentially carry the death penalty, if the prosecution can prove them beyond a reasonable doubt. But it will matter significantly at sentencing when the prosecution bears the burden of presenting what are called aggravating factors, that there was substantial planning and preparation, that the crime was perpetrated in a particularly heinous or cruel nature, whereas the defense will argue minor participation. So the judge will be mindful of the different aggravating and mitigating factors at the sentencing phase. So it's certainly more pertinent down the road.
Those of us who are at a distance from this trial, and certainly not jurors, certainly not in the courtroom, have a hard time attaching to the argument of minor participation when there is video of Johar placing the bombs at the bombing site at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. There is video of him having a shootout with police and all of the other things that went on. It's getting inside the head of two brothers that the defense is asking the jury to do here when there's evidence in the other direction all over the place.
Todd, you're not alone. I think people here in Boston feel the same way. The defense has done a very good job, however, to some extent, of putting Tamerlan on trial. Johar is tried with these offenses, but really it's happening under the shadow of his older brother's legacy. And they're tapping into feelings of sibling rivalry, of older brothers dictating the flow of a younger brother's life. And I agree with you, when you look at the video and you hear this evidence, it's hard to think that Johar was just a minor participant. But the defense, shockingly, has done a really good job, I think, it's hard to say at this point, of at least trying to present that counter story.
What have they done to present Tamerlan, the older brother, as a jihadist, as the driving force behind this conspiracy and these crimes, his interaction with jihadists overseas? What does that picture look like?
Well, there's been a lot of – this is the quintessential 21st century case because there's a significant digital footprint for both Johar and Tamerlan. So there's been a lot of evidence about their online activity, what Tamerlan has done. There's evidence that he downloaded bomb-making instructions, that he frequented jihadist websites, things of that nature. There's also evidence that Johar did similar things as well. But to some extent, their digital footprint has been part of that narrative. Now, whether they succeed or not remains to be seen, and we probably won't know until the sentencing phase.
And we should point out, again, I'm at a distance from this, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that there isn't any direct evidence that Tamerlan drove this conspiracy and that his younger brother tried to resist or said, no, I don't want to do this, or you're making me uncomfortable, and eventually gave in.
Absolutely right. Most of the evidence here is circumstantial. In fact, much of the direct evidence does go against Johar. There's the video evidence of him placing the backpack outside a restaurant in the vicinity of an 8-year-old boy who later died in horrific fashion. There's evidence that was presented at trial that Johar acquired the gun, a Ruger pistol, that was later used to kill MIT police officer Sean Collier. So a lot of the direct evidence does point to direct involvement on the part of Johar. But a lot of the circumstantial evidence does suggest that Tamerlan was the driving force here.
Now, this is a federal case, not a Massachusetts state case, correct? Which means the death penalty is in play. Do we have any sense in a federal case like this how likely that is for Johar Tsarnaev?
It's hard to read the tea leaves on that, Todd. 17 of these charges, as I indicated, could carry the death penalty. There have been two federal death penalty prosecutions in Massachusetts in recent years. If I recall correctly, in one case, the jury voted for death. In another case, they voted for life. So to some extent, we just don't know.
The case of Johar Tsarnaev in the Boston bombing trial 2 years later heads to the jury. Daniel Medved, Northeastern professor of law, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, The Takeaway is teaming up with our friends at the O Miami Poetry Festival and WLRN Miami Herald this month to pay tribute to the least poetic thing about where you live, your zip code. What would an ode to your zip code sound like? Now, Amanda Johansson's zip code is 55108. That's in St. Paul, Minnesota. And she writes this: State Fair on Labor Day, best kind of summer heat, but the 5-month winter frosts over the memory. We can't wait to hear those beautiful summer days either. Amanda, if you'd like to share your own ode to your zip code, you can find more information and submission form at thetakeaway.org. Now, here are the rules, just so you know. That zip code was 55108, and that means her first line, 5 words, second line, 5 words, third line, 1 word, last line, 8 words. You get it? 55108. Now, I live in the 20009. This is a tough contest for me. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to put my mind to it. Share your submissions at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. There have been a lot of calls for more rigorous mental health screening in the aftermath of the Germanwings plane crash. But what if you could do away with the position of the pilot altogether? Commercial flight is already being heavily automated. In fact, in a recent survey of airline pilots operating Boeing 777 flights, on average, those pilots spend just 7 minutes actually piloting the planes manually. And in the future, new advances in airline technology could mean we reach a point where it could be feasible to fly a commercial jet entirely with robots and remote technology. Amy Pritchett is an associate professor of aerospace engineering at Georgia Tech, and she's with me now. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Let's get right to it. Would you get on a flight today with no human pilot?
No.
Would you 15 years from now?
Probably not.
Okay, and this is part of the issue here. The technology is capable. We're going to talk about what robots and artificial intelligence can potentially do on planes, but you're a person just like me, and a lot of people don't want to fly unless a person is in the cockpit, right?
That's true. I have the experience here that I'm actually working on developing and building those systems and then looking at how the pilots interact with them. On average, air transport pilots only fly the airplane by hand a few minutes every flight. But what I'd like to note is that those few minutes that they are flying are the important minutes, the minutes where we're taking off, we're landing at a place that doesn't have the navigation aids for automation to follow down to landing on their own, when there's a collision avoidance alert and the airplane suddenly needs to be maneuvered. Or if anything on board the airplane breaks or it has some unexpected behavior, if there's a need to maneuver around weather, it's those minutes that the pilots are flying. And I'd argue that those are pretty critical minutes that we still need the pilots for.
So with all of the rapidly advancing guidance technology, navigational technology, even landing technology that's used in a lot of aircraft and will be used, you still think that it's not at the point in the immediate future when you could safely pilot an airplane with commercial passengers on board?
We can design automation that works well in expected, normal, nominal conditions. But what we can't design automation for right now is to respond to the unexpected, the unusual. And we're finding that there's malfunctions in flight, many of them small, but still requiring some interaction from the pilot in about 20% of the flights. Something is needed by the pilot to set things right. And in most cases, the vast majority of cases, they're fairly simple. The pilot flies by hand for 1 minute while the other pilot resets a circuit breaker that popped because of a little surge in a circuit. Something very small. But it's only recently that we've analyzed flight data recorder data and realized that these things are so common that, yes, 20% of the flight is our current estimate.
So one of the ideas, and of course, we can all see how airlines and everybody else in commercial aviation would love to cut costs eventually, the military too. A lot of people have had the idea, well, you could cut human pilots in half, still have a human pilot. But then a co-pilot could be back at an office or a base in Milwaukee or Cleveland or someplace like that and co-pilot a couple of dozen planes simultaneously or at least in succession because you only need them for a minute or two per flight to be a human co-pilot. They could do that remotely.
Yes, and there has been a lot of talk about it. Indeed, we would still need the remote co-pilot because if we have one pilot on board, the chance of that pilot becoming incapacitated, whether it's a heart attack or a stroke or the fish dinner that they were served by the flight attendant during cruise, any of those causes are more likely than the safety standards we have. And so we still find that one pilot alone in the cockpit isn't enough. And a lot of the technology that's flying right now was built and developed initially in the 70s and 80s, and it's really proven itself in crews in many fairly normal and stable parts of flight. But we still have these other times, especially around landing, where the autopilot can't do it. The autopilot can land the airplane if everything on the airplane's working, if all the engines are running, and if the airport itself has the radio navigation aids to steer the airplane down to land. But that's not always true. We have our small regional jets going into small airports where the airport itself doesn't have the navigation system, the instrument landing system to bring the airplane down. And the pilot has to execute the landing itself. It's interesting to think, too, if returning to your distant pilot somewhere in a center, then what we would have if we're worried about security is lots of airplanes being controlled from one central location. And the security hazard that that would pose is very interesting. We already have a bit of an equivalent with the air traffic control centers, and a disgruntled contractor employee last September broke into Chicago area air traffic control center, set it on fire, and tried to commit suicide. That brought much of the air traffic control in the Midwest to the halt for several days with massive flight delays. And in that case, what they did is they told the pilots to fly out of the Chicago area to other areas where the control centers were active. If, on the other hand, that air traffic control center had also been controlling the aircraft from the ground, then we would have had a much larger and more significant incident.
That situation means that you have many, many flights vulnerable from one single place. You take over one place, it could affect thousands of flights instead of individual planes.
That's correct, yes. So we talk about hardening the cockpit doors for security reasons, but if we have the airplanes being controllable from the ground, then that ground location becomes a massive target itself. And it's vulnerable both to intentional deliberate acts, but also to things such as power concerns, communication blockages, somebody jamming the radio signals up to the aircraft.
So where does this go? Who wins in this battle between saving millions of dollars on pilot costs and passengers who just aren't going to do it?
I'm not certain that the economic costs really have been fully evaluated. It's easy to say that we could have the cost of the pilots by going from two pilots in the cockpit to one, or just eliminate them. But really, we would be shifting a lot of costs to the ground and adding costs on the ground. So we would be talking about having pilots on the ground who can fly the airplanes. They'd also need to be very trained, very experienced, and indeed their job would be tougher. They would be switching from airplane to airplane that needs attention. And you'd want to make certain that you had plenty of them so that if there's some substantive issue, large thunderstorms at a busy airport, for example, you have enough ground pilots to take over. So we know right now that we operate in a way where we capture the big safety issues before the flight ever takes off, but we know that there's also things that can come up in flight, and we would have to spend a lot more money to develop the airplanes that can handle those unexpected things and have the staff on the ground that would prevent the maintenance issues, to have the staff on the ground that would be trying to respond when the airplane's in the air to those issues.
Amy Pritchett is an associate professor of aerospace engineering at Georgia Tech. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
How do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul?
And here's something to take with you today. Just sold here in New York, the original manuscript and notes to Don McLean's 1971 anthem, American Pie. Christie Auction House sold the lyrics for just over $1.2 million. And according to their website, the, quote, complete working manuscript had numerous revisions and unpublished deleted selections. So Don McLean has previously acknowledged that the song's opening lines are about the death of fellow musician Buddy Holly, but he's never revealed the true meaning behind the rest of the song. Maybe we'll find out that it's just actually about the deliciousness of pie. Who knows? That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.